When the climate had been warmer, civilizations had sloshed back and forth across this glacier-plained landscape for a couple of thousand years, like silt in a miner's pan, forming drifts of built-up stuff that stayed long after the people had departed. At any given moment during those millennia, a billion might have lived on this territory that now supported a few tens of thousands. How many bodies were buried up here? How many people's ashes scattered? 10, 20, 50 billion all told? Given that they all used electricity, how many miles of copper wire had been sown through their buildings and under their pavements? How many man-years had been devoted to the one activity of pulling and stapling those wires into place? If 1 out of 1,000 was an electrician, something like 1 billion man-years had been devoted to running wire from one point to another. After the weather had grown cold again and the civilizations had, over the course of a few centuries, shifted south, moving like glaciers, scavengers had begun coming up here to undo those billion man-years one tedious hour at a time and retrieve those countless miles of wire yard by yard. Professional scavengers working on an industrial scale had gotten 90% of it quickly. I'd seen pictures of factories on tank treads that rolled across the north and engulfed whole city blocks at a time, treating the fabric of the ruins just as a mining robot would an ore-rich hill, grinding the buildings to rubble and sorting the shards according to density. The first ruins we had seen were the feces that those machines left along their paths. Stripping ruins by hand was more expensive. When times were prosperous elsewhere, metals became precious enough that miners could make a life out of venturing to the deep ruins. Far-flung cities of old, never reached by the factories on tank treads, and extracting whatever was most valuable, copper wires, steel beams, plumbing, or what have you. The swag made its way toward the road we were driving in fitful stages, from one anarchic little tundra market town to the next. Snowstorms and Arctic pirate bands might impede its progress, but eventually it found the road and was piled on the backs of ramshackle drummonds that seemed to consist of 75% rust by weight, held together only by rimes of ice and shaggy cloaks of dirty snow. These moved in caravans for protection, so it was hopeless to try to pass them. But they moved fast enough for our purposes, and they afforded us the safety of the herd once they had figured out we were pilgrims, not pirates. We stayed well back of them so that we'd have time to swerve whenever a rigid glyph of plumbing or a hairball of wire fell off onto the road. Our windscreen grew opaque with tire-flung mud ice. We kept the side windows open so that we could reach out and wipe it off with rags on sticks. On the third day, the rags froze. After that, we kept the stove running with a pot of warm water on top of it to thaw them out. Through our open windows, we looked at ruins passing by. We learned to tell what age a place had been built by the character of its fortifications. Missile silos, 3-mile-long runways, curtain walls, stone ramparts, acres of curled razor barbs, belts of sequence-engineered thorn trees, all more or less torn down and deranged by scavengers. As the days went on, all of this stuff was dusted, then frosted, then choked, flattened, crushed, drowned, obliterated by ice. After that, the only things we saw that had been put there by humans were wrecks of former sledge ports. Fluctuations of climate or of markets had left them defenseless long enough to die. The landscape, a mile from the road, was clean and white. That along the road was the most disgusting thing I'd seen the whole trip. The snow piles along the sides of the road grew higher and blacker until our way became a carbon-black slit trench 20 feet deep, crammed with drummonds moving about as fast as a healthy person could walk. After that, there was no escape. We could have shut off our vehicle's engines and the drummond behind us would have shoved us all the way to the end of the road. They had snorkels to draw fresh air down into their cabs. We hadn't thought to so equip ourselves and spent the last day breathing oily blue exhaust. When this became too sickening to endure, we would swap drivers and climb up out of the trench. There were occasional ramps in the snow walls, and simply walk alongside for a while. We had brought snowshoes, improvised from scavenged building materials, in one of the tundra markets, or ride on Gunnell's 3-wheeler. It was on one of those trudges, the very last leg, that Yule finally asked me about the parking ramp dinosaur. Ever since our day together in Norsloff, it had been clear he had wanted to get something off his chest. When he and Cord had suddenly become an item, he had avoided being alone with me for a couple of days. But once it was clear that I was not going to go non-linear, he'd begun a gentle search for opportunities to talk to me one-on-one. I'd assumed the topic was going to be him and Cord, but Yule was full of surprises. "Some say it was a dinosaur, some say dragon," I told him. "One of the first things we were taught about the incident is that nothing can be known of it for certain."
"Since all evidence was wiped out by the encanters?"
"That's one story. The second thing we were taught, by the way, was that we should never discuss the incident with seculars." He got a frustrated look. "Sorry," I said. "That's just how it is. Most accounts agree that one group, let's call them Group A, started it, and Group B finished it. In popular folklore, A equals the so-called Redders and B equals the so-called Encanters. It happened 3 months before the opening of the third sack."
"But the dinosaur, or the dragon or whatever, really did appear in the parking ramp."
Yule and I were walking side by side on compacted snow, a stone's throw off to the right side of the Drummond-jammed slit trench. Closer to it, conditions were dangerous because men, many of them intoxicated, were zipping back and forth on snow machines. The track that Yule and I were following appeared to have been laid down by such a machine a day or two earlier. We could tell where our fetches were in the trench because we had learned to recognize the jury-rigged snorkels of the adjoining Drummonds. The traffic seemed to be accelerating slightly so that we had to mush harder in order to keep pace. This was probably because we were only a couple of miles from the sledge port. We could see its antennas, its smoke, and its lights a couple of miles ahead. Even if the fetches outdistanced us, we'd be able to reach it on foot, so we weren't overly concerned about keeping up. "It was only a couple of thousand feet away from Muncoster," I said. "There was a city there, as there is now. Overall level of affluence and praxic development, let's say 9 on a scale of 10.
"Where are we today?"
Yule asked. "Let's say 8. But the society around Muncoster had peaked, though they didn't know it yet. Deolaters were gaining political influence."
"Which arc?"
"I don't know. One of those that is aggressive about garnering power. They had an iconography."
"A what?"
"Well," I said, "let's just say that they felt threatened by certain things that avowed tend to believe."
"Such as that the world is old,"
Yule said. "Yeah. There had been trouble at a couple of annual apparts and bigger trouble at the decennial of 2780. The tenor's math got sacked a little on 10th night. But then things seemed to calm down. Appert was over. Things went back to normal. So, now, a parking ramp was then under construction within sight of the consent. It was part of a shopping center. The avowed could see it going up just by looking out the windows of their towers. Muncoster has a lot of towers. The ramp was finished a few months later. Seculars went in there every day and parked their cars. No problem. 6 years passed. The shopping center expanded. The workers had to make some structural changes to the parking ramp so that they could attach a new wing. One of them was up on the fourth level, using a pneumatic hammer to demolish part of the floor when he noticed something embedded in the synthetic stone. It looked like a claw. Investigating, they removed more and more stone. It was a major safety issue since the building isn't structurally sound if there are such things as claws and bones and load-bearing members. They had to shore it up. The building was weakening, sagging before their eyes. The more they uncovered, the worse it got. When all was said and done, they had uncovered a complete skeleton of a 100-foot-long reptile embedded in synthetic stone that had only been poured 4 years earlier. The Deolaters didn't know what to make of it. There started to be serious unrest and violence around the walls of the consent. Then one night, chanting was heard from the Thousander's Tower. It went on all night. The next day, the parking ramp was back to normal. So the story goes.
"Do you believe it?"
Yule asked. "Something happened. There were records."
"You mean like phototypes of the skeleton?"
"I'm referring more to things like the memories in the witnesses' minds. Piles of lumber used to shore up the structure, the paperwork at the lumber yard, a little bit of additional wear on the tires of the Drummonds that carried the lumber to the site."
"Like ripples spreading out,"
Yule said. "Yeah. So if the skeleton suddenly vanishes and there's no physical evidence it was ever there, what do you have left?
Only the records,
Yule said, nodding vigorously, as if he understood it better than I.
The ripples without the splash.
The tires of the lumber Drummond didn't suddenly get unworn. The paperwork at the lumberyard didn't vanish from the files. But now there is a conflict. The world isn't coherent anymore. There are logical contradictions.
Big piles of shoring lumber in front of a parking ramp that never needed to be shored up,
Yule said. Yeah. And it's not that this is physically impossible. Obviously, it is possible to have a pile of wood in front of a parking ramp, or some pieces of paper in a filing cabinet, but the problem, the issue it raises, is that the overall state of affairs just doesn't add up anymore. I was remembering the Pink Dragon dialogue with Orlo, realizing all these months later that his choice of a dragon to illustrate the point had been no accident. He had been trying to remind us of the very incident Yule was talking about. We heard a braying engine behind us and turned around to see Ganeliel Crade headed our way on the three-wheeler. Yule and I exchanged a look that meant, let's not discuss this around him. Yule bent down, scooped up a double handful of snow, and tried to pack it into a ball to throw at his cousin. It was too cold to pack, though. We reached the sledge port at 83 North at 2 in the morning, which only meant that the sun was slightly lower in the sky than usual. The slit road debouched into a plateau of pack ice a mile or two wide, and somewhat lower than the surrounding ice, so that it felt like being on the floor of a large meteorite crater. Here and there, housing modules rose on stilts that could be moved and adjusted when the ice flowed under them. The Drummonds tended to congregate around these. Each was the headquarters of a different scrap dealer, and the drivers would hustle from one to the next, trying to get the best prices for their loads. Other structures served as hostels, eateries, or bordellos. The place was dominated by the sledge train itself. The first time I saw this, with the low sun behind it, I mistook it for a factory. The locomotive looked like one of those city-eating scrap processors. A power plant and a village of housing modules built on a bridge that spanned the interval between two colossal tracks. In train behind it were half a dozen sledges, each built on parallel runners that rode in the ruts of packed snow laid down by the locomotive's treads. The first of these was built to carry shipping containers. They were stacked four high, and an ungainly crane on wheels was laboring to begin a fifth layer. Behind it were a few sledges that simply consisted of great open boxes. Another crane, equipped with pincers easily big enough to snatch both of our vehicles at the same time, was clawing tangles of scrap metal from a pile on the snow and dropping them into these with heart-stopping crashes. The last sledge in the train was a flatbed, a mobile parking lot about half full of loaded Drummonds. We spent a while blundering around, but from having talked to Drummond operators at roadside stops, we had a general notion of how the place worked and some good suggestions on how not to behave. From Simon's research, we already knew that another sledge train had departed 2 days earlier, and that the one we were looking at would continue loading for another few days. Getting about was a hazard, because there were no established rights of way. Drummonds and fetches just moved in straight lines toward whatever their jumped-up drivers wanted to reach. So we tended to use our vehicles even for short movements. We found the office on stilts that booked places on the flatbed and arranged to have both of our vehicles loaded upon it. But we paid a little extra to get Gunnell's fetch situated at the edge rather than in the middle. That way, by deploying planks as ramps, we were able to get the three-wheeler on and off at will. It then became our means of moving around the sledge port, though it could only take two at a time, and so at any given moment, three of us would be marooned. So we rented one of the housing modules on the locomotive and marooned ourselves there. It was cheap. The toilet was a hole in the floor, covered when not used, by a trap door weighed down with slugs of scrap iron so that Arctic gales wouldn't blow it open. A few trips up and down the sledge train in the three-wheeler sufficed to stock our little house with the rations and other goods we had packed into the fetches, as well as a surprisingly comprehensive arsenal of projectile and edged weapons. Ulasitar and Ganeliel Crade might disagree about religion, but in their relationship to arms, they were the same mind in two different bodies. They even used the same types of cases to store their guns, and the same boxes for ammunition. Many at the Sledgeport carried weapons openly, and there was a place at the edge of town where people would go out and discharge weapons into the encircling ice wall just to pass the time. On the whole, though, the place was more orderly and predictable than the territory we had spent the last week driving through. As I was coming to understand, it had to be thus because it was a place of commerce. Once we were settled in, Saman and I took the three-wheeler and made the rounds of bars and brothels, just to confirm that Orlo wasn't in any of them. Cord clambered around on the locomotive, admiring its workings, and Yule followed her. He claimed to be as interested in such things as Cord, but to me it was obvious that he expected she'd be raped if she went out alone. We killed time for several days. I tried to read some theorics books I'd brought, but couldn't concentrate and ended up sleeping for unreasonable amounts of time. Saman had found a place near an office module where he could get patchy connections to the reticulum. He went there once a day, then came back to scan through the information he had acquired. Yule and Cord watched Spiele's on a tiny Jija screen when they weren't gathering firewood. Ganeliel Crade read his scriptures in Old Bayesian and began to signal interest in something that he had been polite enough to avoid and that I had been dreading. Religion. Saman once saved me from a near brush with that by looking up suddenly from his Jija, finding my face at the other end of the room, then dropping his gaze again to the screen. He had recently come back from one of his data-foraging expeditions. There were still a few clots of ice dangling from his whiskers. I went over and squatted next to his chair.
After we left Sambol, I began trying to obtain access to certain reticules, Saman explained. Normally these would have been closed to me, but I thought I might be able to get access if I explained what I was doing. It took a little while for my request to be considered. The people who control these were probably searching the reticulum to obtain corroboration for my story.
How would that work? I asked. Saman was not happy that I'd inquired. Maybe he was tired of explaining such things to me, or maybe he still wished to preserve a little bit of respect for the discipline that we had so flagrantly been violating.
Let's suppose there's a Spiele captor at the mess hall in that hellhole town where we bought snow tires.
Norslav, I said.
Whatever. This Spiele captor is there as a security measure. It sees us walking to the till to pay for our terrible food. That information goes on some reticule or other. Someone who studies the images can see that I was there on such and such a date with three other people. Then they can use other such techniques to figure out who those people are. One turns out to be Fra Erasmus from Sot Edhar. Thus, the story I'm telling is corroborated.
Okay, but how?
Never mind.
Then, as if he had grown weary of using that phrase, he caught himself short, closed his eyes for a moment, and tried again.
If you must know, they probably ran an Asamakra on me.
Asamakra?
Asynchronous, symmetrically anonymized, moderated open cry repute auction. Don't even bother trying to parse that. The acronym is pre-reconstitution. There hasn't been a true Asamakra for 3,600 years. Instead, we do other things that serve the same purpose and we call them by the old name. In most cases, it takes a few days for a provably irreversible phase transition to occur in the reputon glass, never mind. And another day after that to make sure you aren't just being spoofed by ephemeral stochastic nucleation. The point being, I was not granted the access I wanted until recently.
He smiled, and a hunk of ice fell off his whiskers and landed on the control panel of his Jija.
I was going to say, until today, but this damned day never ends.
Fine. I don't really understand anything you said, but maybe we can save that for later.
That would be good. The point is that I was trying to get information about that rocket launch you glimpsed on the Spiele.
Ah, and have you succeeded?
I'd say yes. You might say no, because you avout like your information tidily written down in a book and cross-checked by other avout. The information we trade in is noisy and ambiguous and suggestive. Often it's images or acoustical signatures instead of words.
I accept your rebuke. What have you got?
8 went up on that rocket.
So the official statement was a lie, as we suspected.
Yes.
Who were they?
I don't know. That's where things get noisy and ambiguous.
this thing was very hush-hush, military secrets and so forth. There is no passenger manifest that I can read to you, no stack of dossiers. All I have is 10 seconds of really bad images from the collision avoidance spielicapter on the windscreen of some janitor's fetch, taken while he was parallel parking in a tight spot a quarter of a mile away. Motion artifacts have been removed, of course. Saman caused the G-Jaw to begin playing back a snippet of, as advertised, terrible spiely data. It showed a coach with military markings parked next to a large building. A door in the side of the building opened. 8 people in white coveralls came out and climbed into the coach. They were followed by others who looked like doctors and technicians. The interval between the building and the coach was about 20 feet, so we got to see them walk that far. Saman made the thing run on infinite loop. The first couple of dozen times through, we focused all of our attention on the first 4 people in the white suits. Faces were impossible to make out, but it was surprising how much could be inferred from how people moved. 3 of the white-suited people moved in an ever-shifting triangle around a 4th, who was bigger than all of them, with prepossessing hair. He carried himself erect and moved in a heedless line. The others scurried and weaved. His coverall was subtly different from the others. It had a pattern of stripes or markings crisscrossed over it, almost as if he had been draped in a few yards of rope, I said, freezing the image and pointing to it. I've seen something like that before, at Appert. There was an extra wearing something like that. He was a Warden of Heaven priest. That is their ceremonial garb. By this point, Cord had come over to watch the Spiele with us. She was standing behind Saman's chair, looking over his shoulder. Those 4 who were bringing up the rear, she said, they are avowed. Until now, we'd only had eyes for the high priest and his 3 acolytes. The other half of the crew didn't do much, just walked in single file from the building to the coach. What makes you say that? I asked. That is, other than the fact that they show 0 interest in the guy with the rope, there is nothing to mark them as avowed. Yes, there is, Cord said. The way they walk. What are you talking about? We're all bipeds. We all walk the same way, I protested. But Saman had twisted around in his chair to grin up at Cord. He nodded enthusiastically. You 2 are nuts, I said.
Cord is right, Saman insisted.
It couldn't have been more obvious at Appert, Cord said. Extras swagger and slouch. They walk like they own the place. She got out from behind the chair and strode down the middle of the room in a rolling, easy gait. Avout and Ida are more self-contained. She drew herself up and walked back to us with quick steps, not moving any air. As crazy as this sounded, I had to admit that during Appert I'd been able to tell extras apart from Fraz and Sewers at a distance, partly based on how they moved. I turned my attention back to the screen. Okay, I'll give you that one, I said. The more I look at them, the more familiar that gait seems to me, especially the tall one bringing up the rear. He is a dead ringer for... I couldn't get a word out for a few moments. Everyone looked at me to see if I was okay. I couldn't take my eyes off of that Spiele. I watched it 4 more times, and each time I grew more certain of what, of who, I was seeing. Chesri, I said. Oh my God, Cord exclaimed.
His blessings and mercy upon you,
hissed Ganeliel Crade, as was his custom when anyone used that word in an oath. That is absolutely your friend, Cord said. Fra Jesri is in space with the Warden of Heaven, I shouted, just to hear it.
I'm sure they are having some fascinating discussions, said Saman.
A couple of hours later, after we had covered the windows and tried to sleep, the place began to hum and rumble, and there came a jerk that made half of our stuff fall to the floor. Ganel and I unzipped the legs of our suit sacks and ran out to the catwalk and looked down to see rimes of ice exploding into sparkling clouds as they were crushed by imperceptible shifting of the tread segments. We scurried to the end of the catwalk, where a stair led down to near snow level, and jumped off, got the 3-wheeler started, and buzzed back to the flatbed. Explosive bangs resonated up and down the train as the locomotive budged forward and began to draw up slack. A couple of the flatbed's boarding ramps were dragging on the ice so that the last-minute loading could proceed. It would be half an hour before the train was really moving. We blasted up one of these, veered around a Drummond that was back and forthing into a tight slot, and found our way to Gunnell's fetch. We ran the three-wheeler up the plank ramps and stowed the planks under the fetch. Then we spent a while draining the coolants from all three vehicles' engines and storing it in poly jugs. By the time we were finished, the train was moving faster than we could walk in snowshoes, so we made our way forward along the system of catwalks that skirted the sledges and linked them together. Cord and Yule had pulled up the window coverings to let the sun in and were cooking a big celebratory breakfast. We were on our way to the North Pole. I was glad of that, but when I thought of Fra Jesri in orbit, I couldn't have felt more in the wrong place.
Bastard, I said.
That bastard! Everyone looked at me. We had pushed back from what, in these circumstances, counted as a huge breakfast. Ulessitar Crade looked at Cord as if to say, "Your sib, your problem."
"Who? What?" Cord asked.
"Jesri!
A few hours ago you were about to start weeping over Jesri. Now he's a bastard?"
"Oh, this is so typical," I said.
"He gets launched into space frequently?" Saman asked.
It's hard to explain, but of all of us, he is the one they would pick."
"Who's they?"
Cord asked. "Obviously, this was not a Convox operation."
"True, but the secular power must have gone to the hierarchs at Tredegar and said, 'Give us four of your best,' and this is what they came up with."
I shook my head. "We must be proud."
"A little bit,"
Cord tried. I put my hands over my face and sighed. "He gets to go meet aliens. I get to ride on a junk train." Then I uncovered my face and looked at Gunnell. "What do you know about the Warden of Heaven?" Gunnell blinked. He froze for a moment. I had been avoiding religion for so long, and now I had asked him a direct question about it. His cousin exhaled sharply and looked away, as if he were about to witness a traffic accident.
"They are heretics," he said mildly.
"Yes, but almost everyone is to you, aren't they?" I said. "Can you be any more specific?"
"You don't understand," Gunnell said. "They aren't just any heretics. They are an offshoot of my faith."
He looked at Yule.
"Of our faith."
Cord elbowed Yule, just in case he had missed this.
"Really?"
I asked. "An offshoot of the Samblites?" This was news to the rest of us.
"Our faith was founded by Sant Bly," Gunnell claimed. "Before or after you ate his—"
"That," said Gunnell,
"is an ancient lie invented to make us seem like a bunch of savages."
"It's almost impossible to saute a human liver without bruising it,"
Yule put in.
"Are you saying that Sant Bly turned into a Diolater, like Estimard?"
Gunnell shook his head.
"It's a shame you didn't have an opportunity to talk more with Estimard. He isn't a Diolater as you would define it, or as I would. Neither was Sant Bly, and that's where we differ from the Warden of Heaven people."
"They think Bly was a Diolater?"
"Yes. Sort of a prophet, according to them, who found a proof of the existence of God and was thrown back because of it."
"That's funny, because if anyone actually did prove the existence of God, we'd just tell him, 'Nice proof, Frau Bly,' and start believing in God," I said. Gunnell gave me a cool stare, letting me know he didn't believe a word of it.
"Be that as it may," he said levelly, "it's not the version put out by the Warden of Heaven."
My mind went back to Apert Eve and the discussion of iconographies with Grand Sewer Tamara.
"This is an instance of the Brumagian iconography," I said.
"What?"
"The Warden of Heaven is putting out the story that there is a secret conspiracy in the Mathic world."
"Yes,"
Gunnell said. "Something of great import, in this instance, the existence of God, has been discovered. Most of the avowed are pure of heart and want to spread the news, but they are cruelly oppressed by this conspiracy which will stop at nothing to preserve the secret."
Gunnell was getting ready to say something cautious, but Yule spoke first.
"You nailed it."
"That is disheartening," I said, "because of all the iconographies, the ones based on conspiracy theories are the hardest to root out."
"You don't say,"
Saman said, looking me in the eye. I got embarrassed and shut up for a bit. Cord broke the ice.
"The cousin's ship is still being kept secret, so we don't know what the Warden thinks about it. But we can guess. They'll see it as a
miracle,"
Yule said. a visitation from another world, pure and better than ours, I guessed. Where the evil conspiracy doesn't exist, Cord said. Come to reveal the truth.
What about the laser light shining down on the three inviolates? Saman asked. How would they interpret that?
Depends on whether they know that the three inviolates are nuclear waste dumps, I said.
What? The Krades exclaimed.
Even if they do know that, Cord said, they'd probably give it a more spiritual interpretation. Ganil was still a little off balance, but he put in,
The Warden of Heaven sees the Thousanders as the good guys.
Of course, I said. They know the truth, but they can't get the word out because they're bottled up by conniving tenors and hundreders, is that it?
Yes,
Ganel said.
So he would interpret the laser light as...
A blessing, Cord said. A benediction, I said.
An invitation,
Yule said.
Boy, are they in for a surprise,
Saman said delightedly.
Probably. Maybe.
We don't know. I just hope it isn't a nasty surprise for Jessery, I said.
Jessery the bastard, Cord said.
Yeah, I said, and chuckled.
Jessery the bastard.
I was feeling good because it felt like we had gotten through this without having to endure a sermon from Ganeliel Crade. But my heart fell into my gut as Cord turned to him and asked, Where did the Warden part company from your father, Ganel? The last part of this sentence was a little rushed and muffled, because Yule had playfully reached around her shoulder to clap his hand over her mouth, and she was twisting his fingers backwards as she talked.
We read the scriptures ourselves in the original Bayesian, Ganel said. So you might imagine that we are primitive fundamentalists. Maybe we are in that sense. But we aren't blind to what has happened in the Mathic world, old and new, in the last 50 centuries. The word of God does not change. The book does not suffer editing or translation. But what men know and understand outside of the book changes all the time. That's what you avowed do. Try to understand God's creation without using the direct revelations given to us by God almost 6,000 years ago. To us, you're like people who have put out your own eyes and are now trying to explore a new continent. You're grievously handicapped, but for that reason, you may have developed senses and faculties we lack.
After a few moments' silence, I said, I'm just going to hold my tongue and not even get into all that is wrong in what you've just said. The gist of it seems to be that we aren't evil or misguided. You think that in the end, we'll agree with the book.
Of course, said Ganel. It has to be that way. But we don't think there's a secret conspiracy to hide the truth. He believes your confusion is genuine,
Yule translated. Ganel nodded. That's very considerate of you, I said.
We preserved the notebooks of Saint Bly, Ganel said. I've read them myself. It's obvious he was no Deolater.
Excuse me for saying so, Saman said.
This was always how he opened when he was going to insult someone.
Isn't it a little bit nutty for a bunch of Deolaters to found a religion based on the writings of someone they know to have been an atheist?
We identify with his struggle, Ganel said, not the least bit insulted. His struggle to find the truth.
But don't you already know the truth? We know those truths that are in the book. Truths not therein we feel, but we don't know.
That sounds like something, I began, then bit my tongue.
That an avowed would say? Like Estimard or Orlo?
Let's not bring him into this, please.
Fine, Ganel shrugged. Orlo kept to himself, preserved the discipline as near as I could tell. I never talked to him.
Here I had to draw back, count to 10, take out the rake. These people cared about eternal truths, believed that some, but not all, such truths were written down in a book, that their book was right and the others wrong. This much they had in common with most of the other people who had ever lived. Fine, as long as they left me alone. Now they had this new wrinkle. They drew inspiration from a saint of the avowed. It was not important that I be able to make sense of this.
You feel the truth, but you don't know it, Cord repeated. Your service the other day in Samble, we could hear your singing. It was very emotional.
Ganel nodded.
That's why Estimard attends, though he doesn't believe.
He's not intellectually convinced of your arguments, Cord translated. But he feels some of what you feel.
That's exactly it. Ganeliel Crade was delighted. A strange thing to relate, but he was, as if he had found a new convert.
Well, even for one who doesn't believe, I can sort of understand the attraction, Cord said.
I gave her a look. Yule clapped his hands over his face. Cord became defensive.
I'm not saying I'm likely to join this Ark, just that it was remarkable after driving through the middle of nowhere for hours to come upon this building where people were gathered together and to feel the emotional bond that they shared, to know that they've been doing it for centuries.
Our Ark, our towns like Sambal, Ganel said. They are all dying. That's why those services are so emotionally intense.
This was the first thing he had ever said that didn't bristle with confidence, so we were taken aback by it. Yule took his face out of his hands and blinked at his cousin.
Dying because of the Warden of Heaven?
Saman guessed.
He preaches a simple, unsubtle creed. It spreads like a disease. Those who adopt it turn around and spurn us as if we were the heretics. It is wiping us out, Ganel said,
and aimed a none-too-friendly look at Yule. This was all very interesting, but I had other stuff to think about. So Estimard has gone off the deep end. Has Orlo? I recalled the conversation I'd had with Orlo just before the Starhenge had been closed, the one about beauty, the one that had saved my life. In retrospect, it could be seen as the moment when Orlo's mind began to crack, as if he had started and I had stopped being crazy at the same moment. I shook it off. Orlo had been thrown back. He'd had only one place to seek refuge, Bly's Butte. Once there, he'd observed the discipline. No singing in the Ark for him, and he had gotten out of the place as soon as he had been able to.
Well,
wait a minute. Not as soon as he had been able to. He had departed for the north only a couple of days before we had, the morning after the lasers had shone down upon the three inviolates. Why would that cause him to pack up his bolt, cord, and sphere and hurry to Ekba, of all places?
Maybe in a few days I could just ask him.
All's well. A naturally occurring chemical that, when present in sufficient concentrations in the brain, engenders the feeling that everything is fine. Isolated by Theors in the first century AR and made available as a pharmaceutical, it became ubiquitous when a common weed, subsequently known as blithe, was sequence-engineered to produce it as a byproduct of its metabolism. Blithe was subsequently made one of the 11. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
The journey lasted about 2 days, or up here, 2 waking and sleeping cycles. I was all of a sudden ready to get back to work. The journey from Sambal to the Sledgeport had been a welcome respite from reading and thinking, but seeing Jessery had shocked me awake. I might be sleeping 12 hours at a time and watching Spielies, but my friends were working as hard as ever and going off on dangerous missions. It was difficult for me to act on this, though. The continuous vibration and occasional jarring shifts of the sledge train were about as far as you could get from the cloister. Reading and writing were difficult. Even watching Spielies was hardly worth it. Going outside was out of the question. I could understand why so many people up here were substance abusers. Before we had departed, Saman had done research on how to sneak across the border without documents. Economic migrants did this all the time, and some of them had logged their experiences, which gave me a rough idea of what and what not to do. The most important thing not to do was to ride the sledge train the whole way. Apparently, the sledge port on the other side was a much more fastidious operation than the one we had passed through. Officials would board the train at an outpost, a couple of degrees north of the port, and make a sweep down the length of the train during the last few hours of the journey. You could try to hide from them, but this was chancy. Instead, illegals tended to jump off of the train just short of the outpost and make deals with local sledgemen who would spirit them past the border post. These came in 2 categories. The older, more established smugglers had bigger, long-haul sledge trains that they would drive over the mountains to the icebound coast, a couple of 100 miles away. There was also a newer breed using small, nimble, short-range snow machines just to circumvent the sledge port itself. We were hoping to get me on one of those. but the little ones couldn't operate in foul weather. Of course, all of this smuggling could have been stopped if the secular power had been serious about doing so, but it seemed they were willing to look the other way as long as illegals showed them the courtesy of being a little bit sneaky. Because of the cousins jamming the nav satellites, we could not know our latitude, but we could guess how far we had come by dead reckoning. When we thought we were getting close, I put on all the warm stuff I had and topped off the fuel bladder in my suit sack. The backpack I'd been issued at Voca was too small, too new, and too nice-looking, but Yule said he had an old one in his fetch that was bigger, with a metal frame. So we bundled ourselves up and made our way back over the catwalks to the flatbed in the rear. Our backs were to the wind, but we staggered and flailed as the sledges bucked over ridges in the ice. We had to shovel 3 feet of snow off his vehicle. More snow began to fall while we were doing this, and at times it seemed to come down faster than we could get rid of it. But eventually we got into the back of Yule's fetch and found an old military backpack that wouldn't be too conspicuous in the company I'd soon be keeping. I transferred the contents of my little rucksack into it. We filled the remaining volume with energy bars, spare clothes, and other odds and ends, and strapped a pair of snowshoes to the sides, just in case. Back at the head of the train, Gunnell supplied me with coins, enough to pay for passage if I haggled, not enough to stain me as rich. Simon printed out a map of the region around the sledge port. Cord gave me a hug and a smack on the cheek. I went out on the catwalk, pulled the fake fur fringe of my hood out to shield my face from wind blast, and looked out the left side of the train. Like a litter of cubs following their mother, 3 much smaller sledge trains were now shadowing us on that side. They had materialized out of the storm in the last quarter of an hour. Each consisted of a tracked snowcrawler drawing a few sledges behind it. Some of those sledges were open boxes or flatbeds. These were for smuggling goods, and indeed one was now being laden. It had pulled alongside the 3rd sledge in our train, and men were throwing boxes and kicking gravid bags down into it. Others, though, were covered. Tents had been pitched on their backs. I spied a couple of men in orange suit sacks vaulting down into one of those. Simon had given me 1 guideline and 2 rules. The guideline? Get on a sledge with lots of other passengers. There's safety in numbers. Rule 1. Don't let your feet touch the surface. You'll be abandoned and you'll die. Rule 2. I'll get to presently. Gunnell and I paced the catwalks for a quarter of an hour, hoping to see something smaller than these 3 trains. Tiny as they might have seemed next to the giant sledge train, they were quite a bit bigger than most vehicles you'd see on a road down south. They were probably bound west over the mountains. We did not see any of the smaller, more agile vehicles that made short-range smuggling runs in the vicinity of the sledge port. None of them was out today, probably because of the foul weather. One sharp-eyed sledge man spied me. He gunned his engine, coughing out a roil of black exhaust, and pulled alongside. He had only 1 sledge behind his crawler. He slid his window open and stuck his ruddy, hairy face out and quoted a price. I walked back a few steps so that I could look into his sledge. Empty. He quoted a lower price before I said a word. It didn't feel right to jump into the first one that came along, so I shook my head, turned away, and headed back towards where a larger train was taking on passengers. This operation seemed more professional, if that word made any sense here. But I'd arrived late. The sledges were already crowded with what looked like organized bands of migrants whose stares suggested I wouldn't be welcome. And the price was high. A 3rd, smaller train of mixed cargo and passenger sledges looked more promising. There were enough passengers aboard that I didn't fear being abandoned. Seeing me and a couple of other singletons in negotiations with the driver of that train, the 1st sledge man swooped in again. He pulled ahead so that I could look in through the flaps of the tent on his sledge and see that he had taken on 2 passengers. The door of his crawler was hanging open so I could see his control panel. A glowing screen was mounted above it, showing a jagged trace that scrolled horizontally as we moved. A sonic. Rule 2 was that I should never entrust myself to a sledge that lacked one. It used sound waves to probe the ice ahead for hidden crevasses. Most crevasses could be bridged by the tractor's long treads, but some might swallow it and everything in train behind it. I asked the driver where he was headed.
Kolya,
he answered. The longer, mixed passenger cargo train was bound for another place called Imnash. The next icebreaker we knew was scheduled to leave from Kolya in 31 hours. So, having agreed on a price, I heaved my backpack down into the one-sledge train and became its third passenger. According to custom, I paid the driver half of the agreed-on fare up front and kept the other half in my pocket, payable on arrival. For another quarter of an hour, he jockeyed for position along both flanks of the train and managed to collect one more passenger on the right side. By that point, no one remained on the catwalks. All of the little sledge trains peeled away from the big one as if they had received a common signal. I reckoned we must be drawing close to the outpost where the inspectors would board the train. At 50 feet, we could barely see the giant train. At 100, it was invisible. A minute after that, even the throbbing of its power plant had been muffled by the snow and drowned out by the higher-pitched note of our little train's motor. This was hardly the sort of thing I'd had in mind when I'd walked out of the chancel at the Big Voco 2 weeks earlier. Even when I'd made the decision to follow Orlo over the pole, I hadn't dreamed that the last leg of the journey was going to be like this. If someone had told me back at Samble that I was going to have to go on a ride like this one, I'd have come up with an excuse not to and gone straight to Tredegar. What wouldn't have been clear to me, though, back in Samble, was just how routine this all was. People did it all the time. All I needed to do was kill 24 hours, which was how long it would take for this contraption to reach the sea. We four passengers sat on a pair of sideways-facing benches that could have accommodated 8. We all looked about the same in our suit sacks. Mine was new compared to theirs, even though I'd been living in it for a week. Despite the trouble we had gone to outfit me with desperate-looking baggage, mine still gleamed in comparison with the first two passengers. Polly's shopping bags bound up with polytwine and reinforced with poly tape. The last passenger had an old suitcase bound up in a neat gridwork of yellow rope. The first two called themselves Lero and Dag. The last was Braj, all of these being reasonably common extramuros names. I said my name was Vit. Further conversation was difficult over the engine noise, and in any case, these guys didn't seem very talkative. Lero and Dag huddled together under a blanket. I had the idea that they were brothers. Braj, having entered last, sat closest to the flaps in the rear. Between his bulk, he was a little bigger than I, and his clumsy suitcase, he claimed a lot of space. But it was space that we were glad to let him have because of the snow that swirled in from the sledge's coiling wake. I had left all my books with Cord. No one had a spiele. Playing cards was impossible while wearing mittens. There was nothing to see outside but swirling snow. I set my catalytic heater to the lowest power level that would keep my digits alive, folded my arms, propped my legs up on my pack, slumped down on the wooden bench, and tried not to think about how slowly time was passing. It seemed like years since I'd been in the comfortable surroundings of the Consent. But here on this sledge, I'd gone into a daydream where I could practically see my Fras and Sewers in front of me and hear their voices. From Arcibald, Leo, and Jessery, I moved on to the decidedly more enjoyable image of Ayla. I was fancying her at Tredegar, a place of which I knew little except that it was older and much bigger than St. Edhar, and that the climate was better, the gardens and groves lusher and more fragrant. I had to interpolate a fantasy wherein I survived this trip, found Orlo, got back to Tredegar, and was allowed in the gate as opposed to being thrown back or spending the next 5 years with nothing except the book to keep me company. Having got those formalities out of the way, I conjured up a half-waking dream of a fine supper in a rich old Tredegar refectory, at which Fras and Sewers from all over the world raised glasses of really good-tasting stuff to me and Ayla, for having made those pinhole camera observations. Then the daydream took a more private turn, involving a long walk in a secluded garden. This made me drowsy. It was not turning out as I'd expected. Whatever part of my mind was in charge of daydreams was shaping this one to comfort me and lull me, not to arouse passions. A shift in the sledge's attitude brought me just awake enough to know I'd been sleeping. In going over the pole, we had followed a stocky isthmus. Two tectonic plates had collided in the far north and pushed up a range of mountains that would have been tricky to pass over if they hadn't been buried under 2 miles of ice. During the last day or so, the continent had broadened beneath us, but we had stayed to the right, or, now that we were southbound, western side of it. Not all the way to the edge, for the western coast was a steep subduction zone mountain range. There was very little level ground between it and the frozen sea, and most of that was covered in treacherous crevasse-riddled glaciers flowing down from the mountains. So instead, the sledge train stayed some miles inland of the coastal range, tracking across a plateau with stable ice. That's where the sledge port stood. Roads ran south from there across ice, tundra, and taiga to connect up with the transportation network that ramified all the way to the Sea of Seas. But the first outpost going that way was hundreds of miles distant. Smugglers, such as the man driving my sledge, could not prosper carrying their passengers such a long way. Instead, they veered to the right or west, bypassing the sledge port and taking one of three passes that slashed through the coastal range to connect with ports on the shore of the ocean. These were reachable from the south via icebreakers. Cord, Simon, and the Crades would simply get into the fetches and drive south from the sledge port. If the weather had been better and the short-range smugglers had been operating today, I could have paid one of them to whisk me around the sledge port and drop me off on the road a few miles south where I could simply have climbed aboard Yule's fetch. Instead, my four companions would drive south without me for a couple of days into a more temperate zone, then swing west and cross the mountains to a harbor called Masht, the home port of the icebreaker fleet. In the meantime, I would buy passage on an icebreaker or one of the convoy ships that followed in its wake. This would bring me down to Masht. Once we'd rendezvoused there, it would be only a few days' drive to the Sea of Seas. So what I was doing now was Plan B, Plan A being the short-range whisk-around, and frankly, we hadn't discussed it in very much detail because we hadn't expected it to come out this way. I had a nagging feeling that I'd made the decision hastily and probably forgotten some important details, but during the first couple of hours on this little sledge train, I'd had plenty of time to think it through and satisfy myself that it would turn out fine. Anyway, when I sensed the sledge changing its attitude beneath me, I took it as a sign that we were beginning the ascent to one of the three passes that connected the inland plateau to the coast. According to Saman, one of these was considerably better than the other two, but was closed by avalanches from time to time. The sledge drivers never knew, from one day to the next, which one they would end up taking. They made up their minds on the spur of the moment based on what they heard from other smugglers on the wireless. Since our driver was in a separate vehicle, sealed up in a heated cab, there was no way for me to overhear his wireless traffic and get any sense of what was going on. A few hours later, however, the sledge's velocity dwindled and it shambled to a halt. We passengers spent a minute or so learning how to move again. I checked my watch and was astonished to learn that we had been underway for 16 hours. I must have slept 8 or 10 of them. Oh, no wonder I was stiff. Viraj hurled a tent flap aside to flood our sledge with gray light, bright but directionless. The storm had broken. The air was free of snow, but clouds still screened the sky. We had paused on the flank of a mountain, but the surface beneath us was reasonably level, some sort of sledge track, I guessed, that traversed the slope through whatever pass our driver had decided to take. Viraj showed no interest in getting out. I got to my feet and made as if I were going to climb over his outstretched legs, but he held up a hand to stay me. A moment later, we heard a series of thuds from the sledge tractor, followed by a peeling and cracking noise as its door was pushed open through a coating of ice. Feet descended steel stairs and crunched on snow. Viraj lowered his hand and drew in his legs. I was free to go. Only then did I remember Saman's warning not to let my feet touch the surface, lest I be abandoned. Viraj, who seemed to have done this before, knew it wasn't prudent to venture out until the driver had exited the tractor. We'd invested in snow goggles at 83. I pulled them down over my eyes and climbed off the sledge to find an unfamiliar man standing on the snow up next to the tractor, urinating on the uphill slope. I reasoned that there must be a bunk in the tractor and that two drivers must spell each other. Sure enough, the first driver now stuck his sleepy-looking face out the door, pulled on his goggles, and climbed out to join the other. They kept the door open, apparently so they could listen to wireless traffic. This came through in rare bursts, weirdly modulated. I could understand enough to gather that it was sledge operators exchanging information about conditions in the passes and who was where, but very little seemed to be getting through. When a transmission did erupt from the speaker, the two drivers stopped talking, turned toward the open door, and strained to follow it. Laro and Dag climbed out and went to the other side, the downhill side, of the sledge. I heard exclamations from both of them. They began talking excitedly. The drivers looked annoyed, since this made it difficult to follow the bursts of distorted speech on the wireless. I went around to the other side. From here we had a fine view down a snow-covered slope, interrupted from place to place by spires of black stone, to a U-shaped valley. We were on its north side. To our right, it broadened and flattened as it debouched into the coastal strip. To our left, it grew steeper as it ascended into white mountains. So we had made it over the summit of the coastal range and were descending toward one of the icebound ports. But that wasn't what had drawn exclamations from Laro and Dag. They were looking at a black snake, 10 miles long, wreathed in steam, slithering up the valley toward the mountains. A convoy of heavy vehicles, jammed nose to tail, all the same color.
"Military,"
announced Braj, climbing out of the sledge. He shook his head in amazement.
"You'd think a war was starting."
"An exercise?" suggested Laro.
"Big one," said Braj in a skeptical tone. "Wrong equipment."
He spoke with such a combination of authority and derision that I guessed he must be retired military, or a deserter. He shook his head.
"There's a mountain division on point,"
he said, and pointed to the head of the column, which I now noticed consisted of several score white vehicles running on treads.
"After that, it's all flatlanders."
He chopped air, aiming for the first of the dark Drummonds, then swept his hand down valley, encompassing the remainder of the column, trailing toward the frozen sea, which could be seen from here as a white, jumbled plateau crazed with blue fractures. A smear of yellow and brown marked the port we were trying to reach. A lane of black water had been gouged by an icebreaker, but was already fading as the ice crowded in behind it. I was not a Praxic, and not an Eta, but I'd seen enough Spielies as a kid and heard enough from Saman to have a general idea of how the wireless worked. There was only so much bandwidth to go around. In most circumstances, it was plentiful. This was true even in big cities. But military used lots of it, and sometimes jammed what it didn't use. The sledge operators up here in these mountains were accustomed to having a nearly infinite amount of bandwidth at their disposal, and had grown dependent on it. They were always swapping reports on the weather and on trail conditions. But at some point during today's journey, our drivers must have noticed something new to them. Transmissions got through rarely and were of poor quality. Perhaps they had thought their equipment was malfunctioning until they had crested the pass and discovered this. Hundreds, maybe thousands of military vehicles, commandeering every scrap of bandwidth. Everything about this was so remarkable that we might have stood there for hours looking at it if Braj hadn't turned to pay attention to our drivers. They were clambering over the tractor, knocking ice from various pieces of equipment, inspecting the treads, rattling the linkages between the tractor and our sledge, checking fluid levels in the engine. Braj was a dour and calm man, but he was extremely attentive, even skittish, to be standing on the snow at a time when both of the drivers had mounted the tractor. After a minute, he simply became too uncomfortable and climbed back aboard. I was happy to follow his example. Only a few moments after I'd settled back into my place, we heard the door of the tractor thudding shut. We called out to Laro and Dag, who were several paces behind the sledge, frozen in amazement at the sight of the convoy. We managed to get Dag's attention. He turned to look at us, but still didn't seem to grasp what was happening until the engine of the tractor roared up and a linkage clanked as it was put into gear. He smacked Laro on the shoulder, then took a couple of paces toward us, grabbing Laro by the collar as he went by and jerking him along in his wake. Braj shifted closer to the back and thrust out an arm in case he had to pull them aboard. I got to my feet and moved closer in case I had to do the same. The tractor's engine roared louder and we heard the distinctive clanking of its treads beginning to move. Laro and Dag reached us at about the same time. Braj and I each grabbed one of their hands and hauled them aboard. Their momentum carried them forward into the front of the sledge. The tread clanks had already built to a steady rhythm. We weren't moving. Braj and I looked out at the snow. Then we looked at each other. Both of us jumped out and ran around to the sides. The tractor was 50 feet away from us and picking up speed. the hitch that had linked it to our sledge was dragging on the snow behind it.
Braj and I started running after it.
The tracks supported our weight most of the time, but every few steps we'd break through and sink to mid-thigh. In any event, I ran faster. I covered maybe 100 feet before the side hatch swung open and the second driver emerged. He clambered out onto a sort of running board above the right tread and let me see a long projectile weapon slung on his back.
"What are you doing?"
I shouted. He reached into the cab, hauled out something bulky, and let it drop into the snow. A carton of energy bars.
"We're going to have to take a different pass now,"
he called back.
"It's farther, steeper. We don't have enough fuel."
"So you're abandoning us?"
He shook his head and dropped out another object, a can of soot sack fuel.
"Going to see if we can beg some fuel from the military,"
he shouted, getting farther away.
"Down there! Then we'll come back up here and fetch you."
Then he ducked back into the cab and closed the door behind himself. The logic was clear enough. They had been surprised by the convoy. They couldn't get to safety without more fuel. If they took us with them on their begging expedition, it'd be obvious that they were smugglers and they would get in trouble. So they had to park us for a while. They knew we'd object, so they had left us no choice. Braj had caught up with me. He had produced, from somewhere, a small weapon. But as he and I both understood, there was no point in taking pot shots at the backside of the tractor. Only it and the two men in it could get us out of here. When Braj and I got back to the sledge, dragging the fuel and the energy bars, we found Laro and Dag kneeling, face to face, holding each other's hands and mumbling so rapidly that I couldn't make out a single word. I had never seen any behavior quite like it, and had to watch them for a few moments before I collected that they were praying. Then I felt embarrassed. I stepped back to get out of Braj's way in case he wanted to join them, but the look on his face as he regarded the Deolaters was contemptuous. He caught my eye and jerked his head back toward the flaps. I joined him outside. Both of us were hooded, goggled, and swathed against the cold. Frost grew with visible speed on our face masks as we talked. Braj had been checking his watch every few minutes since we had been abandoned.
"It's been a quarter of an hour," he said.
"If those guys haven't come back for us in 2 hours, we have to save ourselves."
"You really think they'd leave us here to die?"
Braj chose not to answer that question, but he did offer,
"They might get into a situation where they have no choice. Maybe they can't get fuel, maybe their tractor breaks down, or the military commandeers it. Point being, we have to have our own plan."
"I have a pair of snowshoes."
"I know. We have to make 3 more. Load up your water pouch."
The suit sacks had pouches on the front that could be stuffed with snow. Over time, it would melt and become drinking water. That consumed energy, but it was sustainable as long as the body had food or the suit sack had fuel. We had both, for the time being. We packed ours as full of snow as we could. We replenished our fuel bladders from the cache that the drivers had left for us. Braj interrupted the others' prayers and insisted they also take on water and fuel. Then he had us each eat a couple of energy bars. Only then did we get working. The tent was held up by flexible metal poles. We collapsed it and drew them out. This had the side effect of getting Laro and Dag's attention. Our shelter was gone. They had no choice but to join in our plan. Braj had a pocket tool with a little saw blade. He went to work cutting the tent poles into shorter segments. Once the others saw that there was work to be done, they joined in cheerfully. Dag, who was the sturdier of the two, took over the sawing of the tent poles. Braj had Laro get to work scavenging every inch of rope and twine at our disposal. Then, perhaps leading by example, he undid the yellow rope that he had used to gird his suitcase. This turned out to be some 30 feet long. He undid the latches and dumped out the contents, hundreds of tiny vials, all packed in loose nodules of foam. I hadn't seen such things before, but I guessed that these were pharmaceuticals.
"Child support,"
Braj explained, reading the look on my face. The panels of the suitcase were a tough, leathery material that we cut into slabs to make the platforms of the snowshoes. We bent the tent poles to make crude quadrangular frames and lashed the suitcase panels to them using twine from Laro's and Dag's improvised baggage. This took a while because we had to do it with bare fingers, which went numb in a few seconds. The contents of Laro's and Dag's baggage were mostly old clothes, which they were willing to abandon, and keepsakes of their families, which they weren't. I pulled one of the benches off of the sledge, flipped it upside down, and kicked its flimsy legs off. It would serve as a toboggan. We loaded it with supplies and wrapped them up in what remained of the tent. My pack had already been stripped of its metal frame and of anything that would serve as rope. I added my energy bars and my stove to the supplies, threw away my extra clothes, and put my bolt, my cord, and my sphere, peeled down as small as it would go, into the cargo pockets on the body of my suit sack. I considered adding my cord to our stock of rope, but we seemed to have plenty. Laro had found a 50-foot coil stored under one of the sledge's benches, and we'd been able to make up another 50 by splicing together odds and ends from the tent's rigging and so on. That, plus Braj's 30 feet of yellow stuff, gave us enough that we were able to rope ourselves together at intervals of 30 or 40 feet, which Braj explained would be useful if one of us lost his footing on a steep slope or fell into a crevasse. These preparations consumed almost 4 hours, so we set out late according to Braj's timetable. The convoy down below seemed as though it had not moved an inch. Braj estimated that it was 2,000 feet below us. He said that if everything goes to hell, we should just pull the ripcord and let ourselves slide down the ice to the valley floor, where we could throw ourselves on the mercy of the military. They might arrest us, but they probably wouldn't let us die. It was a last resort, however, because if we tried it, we stood a good chance of falling into a crevasse before we reached the bottom. Braj took the lead. He was armed with a length of tent pole that he would use to probe the snow ahead of him for crevasses. At his hip, he had his sticker, a long, heavy-bladed knife. He claimed that if one of us fell into a crevasse, he would throw himself down and jam this into the ice, anchoring himself so as to arrest our fall. He had me go last and saw to it that I was armed with an L-shaped piece of metal scavenged from the frame of my pack, which I was to use in the same manner. He even had me practice throwing myself down face first and jamming the short leg of the thing into the ice. Dag, then Laro, were roped up between us. The toboggan trailed behind me.